Good. So homework three is now over. So now you're focusing on the project, the phase three of the project. Ian and I, we are focusing on designing phase four of the project, which is going to be totally different. We don't have a good phase four for this toy project. It's too this particular project is too small, too much of a toy to extend it. We actually tried to extend it with indexes, and it doesn't work because the data is so small that indexes, they don't affect performance in any way. So we couldn't extend it with any tuning. So phase four will be completely different. What we are currently doing is we are trying to design some data mining tasks on a very interesting data set. Hopefully that will work. So stay tuned for a very exciting and very undebugged phase four of the project, because this is going to be the first time we are using this particular data mining problem. The next homework will be posted soon, probably tomorrow night or on Thursday. It's going to be on transaction processing, without any programming, or maybe you have one SQL query to write, and some query processing and optimizations. You have to write SQL queries that produce certain plans. It's a fun exercise. It's simple. It will require you to play with SQL Server. The final, we moved it. I didn't hear any objections. Somebody wanted to know more details, and I think it's time to discuss some details, but otherwise there were no objections. So we moved the final for Tuesday, March 13th at 6:30. We only need 2 hours, 6:30 to 8:30, but it's not in this room, because I need everyone in class to come to the final, and this room is too small. So we got a different room, and I sent an email to class. I think it's 037. So that's where the final will be. The final is an open book exam. I probably said it, but let me repeat it. It's an open book exam. You can bring any notes, any printouts, anything except computers. Do not bring computers. And the questions will be definitely some SQL, so you will be asked essentially to write to answer questions in the style of those that we had on the homeworks, designing SQL queries, probably doing some problems on normalization theory, functional dependencies, my next query, stuff like that. There will be no essays. I don't like to grade essays. I like to grade questions with a very sharp answer. It's just my personal preference. Some questions will be just to make sure that you have the background that I'm expecting everyone to get in this class on query processing and queries, and first of all, and then query processing and normal forms. Some questions may be more subtle, more creative. There will be a small challenging part to the final, but I don't want to make it necessarily difficult. But one or two questions out of the total of 10 or so might be harder than the others. Any more questions about the final? Think of it as being like the homeworks. That's the best thing to think about the final. Yeah.
Will it be similar to the finals for the previous classes?
It will be very similar to the finals from the previous classes, and this is why I leave all the finals posted. I tend to take the solutions out if I forget them. Don't look at them. Let me know so I can hide them. So yeah, feel free to look at the previous finals. I think we covered more material. We definitely covered more material than in the undergraduate class, although there is an overlap. In some sense, we covered slightly different kind of material from the graduate level class. So none of the finals is a perfect match, but it's a pretty good match to what we will have in this class. Good. So I'd like to start today's lecture. We stopped last time after we have discussed the lock-based concurrency control manager. And today I'd like to start the lecture by covering the other two concurrency control managers that are not based on locks. But before that, let me ask you this. To what noun do we apply the attribute serializable?
Conflict.
Is a conflict serializable? What is serializable?
Schedule.
Sorry?
Schedule.
A schedule. What is a schedule? It's a sequence of steps from different transactions that are interleaved by the scheduler in order to execute them concurrently. And we know exactly why they have to be executed concurrently, because this is how the system is best utilized. While one transaction waits for an I.O., other transactions might proceed with main memory computations. That's the essence of concurrency, and databases also need to deploy concurrent execution. Good. So now the problem is that different transactions may interfere. The scheduler must ensure a certain property of the transactions, namely that they are that the schedule is serializable, that each transaction is isolated, the I in ACID properties. So what does it mean for a schedule to be serializable? What was the definition? What is a serializable schedule? Yes?
It has the same result as if each transaction executed one after the other serially.
It has the same result as some serial schedule. And there is the emphasis on some is important. It doesn't ask for a certain order of the transaction. Any order is fine, as long as they look as they were executing in isolation serially. Good. But we actually don't care about serializability. We care about something called conflict serializability. What is a conflict serializable schedule? What was that? Well, the problem with serializability was that sometimes, in order to check if a schedule was serializable, we had to understand how the data values, how the data elements are actually transformed. Maybe we can switch to operations and the end result will be the same. And what we said was that for the purpose of the concurrency control manager, we should not look at what operations are done on these data elements. So that justified the definition of conflict serializability, which said that a schedule is conflict serializable if it is equivalent to a serial schedule obtained by swapping adjacent operations that are not in conflict. And what kind of conflict did we have?
Read, write, 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 read.
And that's it. And the fourth conflict was just between two actions of the same transaction. We don't want to slap a transaction over the wrist and decide to execute this action in a different order. Okay, so now we understand exactly what we are looking for. We are looking for a schedule that is not serial, but that is provably equivalent to a conflict serializable schedule. The techniques that we discussed last time was based on locks. So every element has a lock, and the transaction a transaction needs to acquire a lock before it uses the before it accesses the element. Okay, but just using the locks on each element does not ensure serializability. A certain policy of the locks is required in order to ensure serializability. What was the policy that we discussed last time? The two-phase locking. And that policy says what?
Once you release a lock, you cannot acquire any more locks.
That's a perfect way to put it. Once you release a lock, you are not allowed to acquire any other locks. It's easy to visualize it, although it's kind of wrong, that all the locks are acquired at the beginning, and then they are released at the end. It doesn't have to be this way. More realistically, locks are probably acquired during the transaction, and they are held until the very end. But nothing prevents us from acquiring them or releasing them in any order as long as we satisfy this. Once we release, we are not allowed to acquire anymore. Good. So that was a story that we discussed last time. The concurrency control manager based on locks. Today we are going to discuss two different concurrency control methods. One is based on timestamps, and the other, much shorter, is based on validation. So no locks. Let's see the timestamps. So here is the idea. We want to ensure conflict serializability. The idea is that whenever a transaction starts, we will assign to that transaction a unique timestamp. And that's denoted TS of the T. T is the transaction. Think of this timestamp as being a number that's incremented. 1, 2, 3, 4 is incremented by the system whenever a new transaction arrives. Or you can think of it as being the system's clock. And it's unique for each transaction. So once we have this number for each transaction, our goal will be to ensure that the schedule is such that it's equivalent to the serial schedule that is a serial schedule given by this timestamp. So at least we know in which order the transaction should appear as being executing, even if they might execute in different orders, but they should appear as executing in this order. Yes?
So I know we can receive transactions in different orders, but I think there was never a condition for serializability. It seems we're adding a condition to it, right? I mean, earlier, serializable, the server could choose, even if a transaction came later, to execute it first, as long as,
So this is a very good point. By adding this condition, we're actually restricting the kind of schedule that we can permit. For example, it might be the case that we could have a transaction T1 that starts here. Let me do this. So T1, then we have T2, then we have T2. These are actions of transaction. Then T1 again, and time goes that way. And the only way you can serialize this is to place T2 before T1. But with the timestamps based concurrency control manager, this is not possible because the timestamps are assigned when the transactions first arrive. So that means that the timestamp of T1 is going to be less than the timestamp of T2. So the concurrency control manager will enforce this schedule to be equivalent to this one. Yes?
So then if T1 is a 3-month transaction, then all other transactions will wait for that one to complete?
If T1 is a three-month-old transaction, yes. If it's... I'm not sure I can answer this directly other than looking at all the cases of the timestamp.
T1 is starting now, but it's going to take 3 months. You will not commit until 3 months later, and T2 is coming in now. And
yeah, I think you're right. I think it will delay all the others, which is the same as would happen with locks.
Yes. No, it doesn't, though, right? Because with locks, if they're not accessing the same tables, you have no problem.
Oh, no, then I misspoke. So with locks, if they don't access the same table, then T2 doesn't wait for T1. But similarly here. So what I'm going to show you next is that the concurrency control manager will watch for what elements are being accessed. And if there are no conflicts, then it can serialize them in any way. But it will always try to serialize them like this. Okay, so here are the data structures. So we discussed this. The serialization order is a timestamp. Here are the data the data values that a concurrency control manager needs to maintain in order to ensure serializability. Three things. For every element X, it needs to remember the highest timestamp of any transaction that has read X. Okay, whenever a transaction reads X, then the concurrency control manager needs to update this field to the highest transaction that has read X. Write X, which is the timestamp of the highest transaction that has written X. Right now it's mysterious why we need this, but I'll show you in a moment. And then there is an even more mysterious commit flag, which I'm not going to discuss until we need it. So here is the idea. You are the concurrency control manager, and you get requests. You get a request from a transaction T, and that request can be read or write. Here are your worries. Here are your nightmares. T wants to read. So you ask a question. If I allow T to read X, do I generate a write-read conflict? So that means, does this happen? And moreover, the transaction T wants to go before you. His timestamp is less than you. Or here is nightmare number two. T may want to write. So I ask a question, if I allow T to write, do I perhaps generate a read-write conflict? Or do I generate a write-write conflict? So these are the cases we need to check. Let's actually think together. Let me erase this. Let's take the first case. Let me see if that's the one. Read, write. Let's take the first case and think together. How would you check for this occurrence? Well, we don't have a tape with a history, right? It would be nice if we could examine the history and see who wrote X last time. But we have something else about X. We have that timestamp, the write of X. So what do we compare? What do we check to see if we have such a conflict?
Compare it with the timestamp of T.
We compare it with the timestamp of T. When do we have a conflict? So let me actually write it here. TS of T. I don't like what happens here. So what is the relation? What is the sign that I need to put between them to get a conflict?
Greater than.
Because if I put a greater than, it means that you, the transaction you, has to come later than T. And it cannot because of this conflict. We will not be able to swap them when we try to swap them. So that's the idea. It's very simple. So now what we will do next, we will examine all these cases and discover more and more subtleties that need to be handled. So this is the first case that we discussed. So T wants to read, But the transaction that last wrote X has a timestamp that's greater than TS of T, exactly how you told us. So what we have to do here, we simply cannot allow T to proceed. It's not a matter of having T to wait. Even if T waits, nothing good will happen, right? T is doomed. This read is too late. So we need to roll back T. Which means that we need to abort T and restart T at a later time. And this might be left to the application, maybe you return an error code, or might be handled by the system, but we discussed last time that it's not so easy to handle this by the system. It's much easier to return an error code to the application.
Question?
Yes?
Isn't it the job of the scheduler to ensure that that never happens?
Can you please repeat this?
Isn't it the job of the scheduler to ensure that this never happens? Why are we rolling back a transaction as a result of a late write?
Well, not in this scheduler. This scheduler, for this particular scheduler, this is what the scheduler does. It checks for this to happen. It checks for this condition to if it appears, and if it occurs, then it rolls back. So the scheduler does enforce serializability by rolling back transactions that would otherwise violate the serializability. It's a very drastic step to take, but the benefit is that if there are no conflicts, then the scheduler is much more efficient.
So couldn't this cause a chain reaction of having to roll back transactions? I mean, if for instance T had already written something that you had read and earlier on, wouldn't you have to roll back both T and U, and then potentially any other transaction that may have read or written something based on those transactions?
So there will be no chain reaction because of that C flag that we'll discuss. So that's the one that prevents us from doing any chain reactions. If we have to roll back T, we just roll back T. We don't have to check anything else. And this will become clear in a slide or two. So let's see this thing here. So here we want T wants to write, and we check for a read-write conflict. So that means that we need to compare the timestamp of T with the read flag of X. And if this happens, then we have a conflict and we need to roll back T. We cannot allow T to write. We cannot allow T to write because, somebody else who comes after T has already read that value. So T is writing too late. Okay, is this red part clear? Then let's discuss the blue part. Why is this condition here?
If the write to X was already more recent than what we wanted to write, it would have been overwritten anyway, so it did not matter.
Exactly. Very, very good. Very, very nice insight. So let's suppose the converse holds. Write of X. Am I writing here? Let's suppose write of X is greater than the timestamp of T. I'm a little bit unsure about what happens in equality. We'll discuss this later. Let's suppose it's greater than the timestamp of T. So now T wants to write X. How do we reason here? Do we have a conflict? No. What happens is that the value that T would have written in the serial order to X would have been overwritten by the other transaction who has a bigger timestamp. So therefore, this write operation is lost. It's a lost write. So in that case, we simply don't do the write. We tell the transaction everything is fine, but in fact we don't do the write. And that's shown here. So if I go back, this is exactly the blue part, which is right here. So let's discuss again what happens. It's actually quite intuitive. Let me denote with V the transaction that did this write. Here is V. It does this write, and notice that V started later than T because of this condition. So now, in the serial order, this write should be somewhere here, which means that it's going to be overwritten by V. So therefore, we let T proceed. We tell it that the write succeeded, but actually we don't do the write. It's very subtle. But wait a minute, can we really do this? What happens with all the transactions here that might have read X? How do we write? This is not good. Read of X by some transaction Z. They might have read the wrong value. Well, but then we will discover this anyway, because we need to consider the other case, a read-write conflict, and that will be discovered between these two. Okay, now here are more problems. This goes back to the cascading abort question. So suppose we discover a write-read conflict, which is this one here, and this was on one of the earlier slides. So there was somebody wrote X. We want to read it, but we come too late. We should have read it earlier. So we said in that case that the system should abort. It should roll back the transaction T. But actually, that's not always the case. And here is what can go wrong. You, who causes the problems, might abort later. So if you abort, then what can we do with T? We can simply allow it to proceed. So if you abort, then we will feel sorry for having had rolled back T. So what we can do in this case, we can examine the commit flag. So now let's discuss this commit flag. This is set to 1 if the transaction who last wrote X has not committed yet. So essentially this bit says that the last write to X is not certain yet. So in that case, we don't know what to do at this point with T. So then we'll make it wait until the transaction U either commits or aborts. If it aborts, then we can allow T to proceed. If it commits, then we have to abort T. And there are no cascading aborts, and that's important.
If you're making it wait, question?
Yes, question.
If you're making it wait anyhow, why do you need to abort it after the commit occurs?
Can you repeat, please?
Yeah. So if you're going to make T wait on the commit of U.
Yes.
So it's waiting regardless. Why do you need to abort T in the event that U commits?
Well, if T commits, then it means that this write was effective. And it means that T can no longer read the previous value.
Oh, okay. I see. Because it started after T's timestamp.
Right. Because okay. It started after. So that's this condition here. If this condition is not true, then we have no conflict.
Okay.
Okay. So. Similarly, with write after write conflicts. So, if we had a write that came too late, a write after write, we said that we don't have to abort, but instead we simply ignore the write. We need to be careful here too. Yep, we can ignore the write, assuming that the transaction who has written this U has committed. But if it hasn't committed yet, then it depends. If it commits, then we can ignore this new write. If U doesn't commit, then we have to proceed with the write. We don't abort T, but on the contrary, we execute the write. Okay. So what have we seen? We have seen three simple values that are associated to every element. This read timestamp, the write timestamp, and the commit bit. And we have seen how to use them to check for read-write conflicts, for read-write and write-write conflicts. Now, after we check for these conflicts, what can we do? We can either grant the request, allow the read or the write to proceed. We can roll back a transaction. We can make the transaction wait until some other transaction commits or aborts. Or sometimes, if we are lucky, we can simply ignore a write. So this is what we can do. The entire scheduler is based on four long rules in the other textbook, in the textbook by Ullman. They take a whole page. But my claim is that the slides we have seen so far are completely sufficient for you to derive all those rules. So if you have the textbook, you can read that page. If you don't have the textbook, I think the slides are sufficient. You just think about them, and that should be enough for you to derive the entire logic. How many people here have the other textbook? Not that many. Do you have access to a library in case you need to access it?
I don't know. Does the UW library?
Yeah,
I'm sure they would have some copies, right?
They have copies here in the UW library, but I'm not sure how convenient it is for people to come and to read the book. Well, that's an option. If not, maybe you can. What other options are there? This library at Microsoft. I'm sure you have it in the library somewhere. And if you don't have it, again, you can just think about these slides, and I'm sure you will understand the logic. It's pretty straightforward. Good. But this is actually not. This is more for pedagogical reasons. It's one of the time concurrency control managers that has been proposed in the past. I don't think any database system implements it like this. Instead, what they implement is something more subtle. It's called the multi-version timestamp, or the snapshot isolation concurrency control manager. I'm sure you have heard about snapshot isolation. So here is the idea. Most of the conflicts that cause the rollback in the timestamp concurrency control manager are caused by a transaction that wants to read, but it wants to read an old value. because that value was overwritten by another transaction. Actually, that's exactly the reason why we have to roll back. So there is a simple idea to avoid this. Keep the old values around. So that means that from now on, every single element, which means every single page, will have multiple versions lying around in the buffer pool. And when a transaction wants to read, based on its timestamp, we decide which version to give it. It's like saying that when the transaction starts, I mean, the final effect is as if we made a copy of the database when the transaction starts. But actually, we don't make a copy of the database. We only make copies on demand. When pages are written, then we keep the old copy for the transactions who need to use the old copy, and we write in a new version. So let's see the details. They're actually quite fun. So we never overwrite. I'm going to continue to refer to this write flag, but actually this never gets updated. When a transaction when an element is written, a new version is created, and this flag is created once and forever. This value is never updated. So now we have multiple versions of X with decreasing timestamps, and they correspond to the timestamp of the transaction that have written X. Okay, so let's see what we need to do. And the rules are here. Let's read them one by one. So first, when a transaction wants to write it, we just create a new version whose timestamp is the timestamp of this transaction. So rule one is pretty straightforward to understand. So now suppose a transaction wants to read. Let me actually go back. Suppose I'm a transaction called U, and I'm saying read U X. So the concurrency control manager needs to decide which of these versions to return. Which one should it return? So the one with the timestamp T prime that has what property?
Less than
TS of U. However, is less than the next the T double prime which comes next. This is not the best notation here. These timestamps are not decreasing one by one, but they can decrease in larger quantities. So then we return this one. It makes sense. What happens if we have equality? We never talked about equality, but you should think about what happens in the case of equality. Can we have equality? Can we find a version of X that is exactly the timestamp of the transaction that wants to read it?
If it's the same transaction reading the same thing.
Exactly.
Or if there's a bug in the implementation.
No. If there is a bug in the implementation, suppose there is no bug in the implementation, we can still get equality if the transaction simply wants to read a page that it has written. Then there will be a version of that page that it has its timestamp, and we just return that version. Okay, more questions. So the write flag never changes. Read must also be maintained to reject certain transactions, to reject certain writes. So there will be some rollbacks. So let's see why. So suppose, let me erase everything here. Suppose there is a read of a transaction performed by a transaction U, whose timestamp is somewhere here, in between these two. Okay, so if I were to draw time, let me draw it going that way, because this is how it goes here. So then version XT minus 2 is here, version XT minus 1 is here, but the timestamp of U is somewhere here. So which version do we give to you to read?
T minus 2.
T minus 2. So far so good. But now suppose a new transaction V wants to write it. And suppose the timestamp of V is right here. So does it work, or are we in trouble?
We're in trouble.
Now we are in trouble, because it means if since time goes that way, it means that we should have returned to you this value, but we didn't have it when you was executing. So now it's too late. So now we need to abort V. We need to roll back V. So this is why we need the right. Well, so we can only do this by examining the read flag of XT minus 2.
Can we abort U instead of V?
We abort
earlier, right? Why would we abort V?
Well, we can only do an action on the current transaction. The other one called U might have committed. I'm trying to imagine trying to look through a backpack of transactions, finding you and aborting it. It's much easier to focus on the current transaction, especially since you might have committed.
So just because we had 4B doesn't mean it's dead, right? We could actually start it with a new timestamp.
Absolutely. So I should have emphasized this. When a transaction is rolled back, it needs to restart. And when it restarts, it will have a much bigger timestamp. So now it has a better chance of succeeding. That's the idea. Okay. And the last question here has to deal with how long we keep these multiple versions in main memory. So somewhere here is the earliest one. X1 being the earliest copy of X. When can we get rid of the earliest copy? At some point we need to be able to get rid of it. We don't write it to disk, we just delete it from main memory, from the buffer pool.
When all transactions up to that point have committed?
When all transactions commit, then we can get rid of it. But that's like a quiescent checkpointing, and no more transactions are active. Yes.
Any transaction that has written it since has committed.
Not even then. The question is. Can there be a transaction around that hasn't written X, but that might decide later to read X? If a transaction decides to read X, we need to be able to return the right version.
So it seems like when no current transaction would ever want that, which would mean they have a timestamp greater than TSX2.
Exactly. So when all the transactions have a timestamp greater than the next one, then this one.
How is that different from saying when every transaction that started before that has already committed?
It's the same thing as saying what you said, namely that every transaction that started before TS of X2, strictly before TS of X2, has committed.
But if a later transaction has, if the transaction that started after but has written to X has committed, then you can also throw it away, because I'm saying it's a
if a later transaction has written X You can't throw it away. Because all that means is that that transaction has written one of these.
Right.
You may still have a very old transaction that wants to read that early version of X.
Professor?
Yes.
So then is the logic of this system that we try to make each transaction act as if it had entirely executed at its timestamp? Right? And we sort of fake the values that it sees so that it thinks it all occurred in a single instant of time. And the rollbacks occur when something happens to make it impossible to do that.
That's a very good way to say it. That's exactly what happens. We are trying to fake as if the transactions were executing as a timestamp when they were initially started. And we are faking this. Yes?
Shouldn't every version that has been committed, shouldn't that be written to disk at one point?
Let's ask a higher level question. When do we ever write to disk? When I said we can get rid of the first one, what I mean by this is we actually delete it. Or do we write it to disk?
Depends on the recovery manager.
Sorry?
That's what the recovery manager does.
Well, my argument is that if we have larger versions of the same X, we don't want to write it to disk. Because that's not the version, the value that has to go to disk. So this begs the question, when do we ever write it to disk? When you write, definitely when the buffer manager wants to free a frame, and if it decides, if there are multiple versions of the same page available in my memory, and by the way, this is why you should take Bernstein's course, then you will discuss these subtleties in great detail. So here we're kind of dabbling into these questions. So let's think what makes sense. So if there are multiple versions, so here is one simple answer. If it happens that there is a single version of an element X, then we can apply the old rule. If the buffer manager decides to send it out to disk, it can send it out to disk. Not a big deal. But what happens if there are multiple versions? Maybe we can apply the same logic. Send one to disk and
only if all the previous versions have been sent to disk.
We still need to maintain, we still need to have access to all the versions. So we can't overwrite. So if we send this one to disk and later we send this one to disk, they have to be different elements with their own timestamps. So maybe that's a logic. We just send them to disk and they will have different timestamps. So then every page on disk also has a timestamp.
The question is, how do you ensure that committed transactions are persistent? That, you know, if you die when some of your version is committed in memory, shouldn't it be always written then? Yes.
Well, that's a purpose of the recovery manager. So depending on how the recovery manager works, you need to if you're doing a redo recovery manager, then you need to read the log and update all the elements that were not had been written to disk. So the concurrency control manager and the recovery manager, they do go hand in hand, and there is the answer to this is ARIES. Okay, you read the ARIES recovery manager, and that also talks about issues related to concurrency control, and that gives you all the answers. What we are discussing now are just individual separate principles, as it were, that do not necessarily work together. Yes?
Well, I had a question about, you mentioned earlier that the WTX flag is written once, but it's not needed. I didn't quite catch the significance of that. When is it used and why is it important?
If I said that, then I misspoke. The WT is written once. It is needed, but it is never overwritten. The WT of this version will always remain, so WT of X T minus 2 is always this TS of X T minus 2. Every version has a timestamp and it sticks to that timestamp. Okay, so I'd like to continue to move on. So what are the trade-offs? So locks are good when there are many conflicts. When there are few conflicts, then locks are heavy duty. The operations on a lock are complex. You have to manage queues, and they are heavy duty compared to read or write. On the contrary, dealing with timestamps is easiest when there are no conflicts. If the transactions are mostly independent, if they read and write distinct elements, then the timestamp-based concurrency control manager is the most efficient one, because it only checks on numbers at each operation, and that's it. And these checks are very efficient. So this is great when there are a few conflicts. So the an optimization that people usually cite is this: if a transaction is read-only, then it's implemented with timestamps. But if it is read-write, then it is implemented with locks. And now you probably would ask, how in this world does a concurrency control manager work if it handles both timestamp-based and lock-based? If it applies both methods? And I don't have an answer. I know that that's possible, but this is why you take the next class on transaction management. Yes?
A question. Now, Spicer 2005 implements a snapshot isolation. Is it different or is it the same thing?
The snapshot isolation, to my best understanding, is this one. This is what Oracle implements. However, the snapshot isolation does not check. They do a trick in Oracle. They do not check for one conflict. I think for the write-write conflict, because the write-write conflict is rare. They just don't check for it, and therefore the Oracle when you select the serializable concurrency control mechanism in Oracle, it is actually not fully serializable. It's a dirty secret that wasn't clear for a while, and now it became clear. This is why it's so efficient, because it implements this multi-version timestamp-based concurrency control mechanism, and it skips on some of the checks. It doesn't do the write-write conflict checks. Now, I'm not sure what SQL Server does, if it implements full serializability or not. Since this problem is well understood now, I suppose it implements full serializability. Okay, I don't want to spend too much time because we have also other things to discuss. But I need to show you the last kind of concurrency control that is not based on timestamps. Although it still has some timestamps, but a different kind, which is based on validation. So this is even more aggressive than the previous one, because this does a single verification, it's called the validation, and otherwise it lets the transaction proceed without any checks, without having to check anything at every read or write operation. So that's the most efficient one. So here is how it works. So now each transaction must know ahead of time all the elements that it's going to read and all the elements that it's going to write. And I don't know how this can be implemented in practice. It probably depends on the system. If you think of a transaction in SQL, You can write it in such a complicated way that you're interleaving the reads and the writes. It's impossible to know all these sets ahead of time. But for some applications, that might be possible. So RS denotes a set of elements that T wants to read. WS denotes a set of elements that T wants to write. Suppose that we have this. Then the transaction proceeds in three phases. First it reads. At the end it writes. It can do computations whenever it wants. But in the middle, it needs to do something called validation. This is when the concurrency control manager does all the checks to ensure that this is a complex serializable schedule. At the beginning of the validation, this is when the timestamp is computed, and that will be the serialization timestamp for the transaction, called val of t, the validation timestamp. We also need the other timestamps when the transaction started and when it finished. And amazingly, there are only two simple cases that need to be examined on two slides. Well, they are simple, but they're not that simple. We need to wake up. So let me read it correctly. If I read it incorrectly, I always get stuck here. We are T. The only difficult question on this slide is who are we? And if I guess it's wrong, then it's bad. But I got it right. We are T. We are transaction T. So this is what we did. We read, and now we want to validate. We are right here. So our validation time will be this if we succeed. But we need to check for read write and for write conflict. So let's check here for write read conflict. So is there a transaction that is there a transaction that should come before us and that normally should write before us, but that's in danger of doing the actual writes after us? So that's a transaction U. U, what do we know about U? U has validated. Since U has validated, we know for sure that its timestamp, which is the serial order, is greater than ours because we have not validated yet. So we know that U comes before us. But on the other hand, if U had terminated, then U would have looked like this. Read, validate, write. And it has terminated, and there is no worry. There is no worry for us, because if U had terminated before we even started, then everything is according to the serial order. That happens when the finishing time of U is less than the start time of our transaction. This one here. Okay, so that would be a happy case. The unhappy case is this one, which is shown in the picture. The finishing time of U came after, or will come after, we started reading our elements. So this condition that I just encircled, this checks for potential write-read conflict. So if this happens, then we need to check if our read set intersects with the right set of U. And if it intersects, then we have a conflict, then we roll back. And if it doesn't intersect, then we are okay.
Do you need another condition that like U starts before T?
That U starts before T. Yes, but we this is implicitly is implicitly captured by the fact that U has validated.
You could start later than T, right? Suppose U doesn't read anything at all, right? While T reads an enormous amount of stuff, U could quite easily start later than T. All that matters is that it validated, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So let me make this actually more precise. So U could be like this. This is what he says. This is now the new U. It reads, maybe reads nothing. Then it validates, and then it starts writing. So its start time is after hours, but this is not the serialization time. The serialization time is given by the validation time, which is here, and hours will be here.
I mean, is there a reason that that isn't part of the if statement? It's just like in parentheses, like in the words. We can't even write that with.
It's not.
Less so, than value.
So the point of this picture is to show that there is no condition between start U and start T.
Yeah, it sounds like there is one between value and value.
There is a condition between value and value. That's correct, but that's already captured on the slides. How? It doesn't say. But I had it there. I erased it. It's a very subtle point. So let me erase everything again. And so what he wants to say is this. He wants to say that we need to check that U comes before T. Not that it started before T, but it's serial. That the serial order is before T. And my point is we don't need to ask this. It's already captured by the other conditions.
The intersect.
No, not the intersection. It's in parentheses. U has validated.
How do you check that if you don't? I mean, don't you check that by looking at value?
Well, the trick is that we don't have val t. We will have val t when we finish validation, the validation. No. But we know val, this comes in the future. And since U has already validated, this condition is automatically satisfied.
We don't have thin U either, because U may not have finished yet.
We don't know if U... it doesn't matter... Let me think. It doesn't matter whether U has finished or not.
I'm saying the slide mentions thin U, and that we may not have access to that.
Right. So this condition is a little bit misleading.
Yeah.
We can read it this way. We need a proof that U will finish after T has started. But it doesn't mean that we have fin U. Fin U may come in the future, and this condition is still satisfied.
So all we're really checking is value is less than current time. Right? We don't know about T, but we know value, and it's less than now. Right?
Yes, yes. That's exactly what we do. That's all we check. Okay, this is one case, and then there is a second case where we check. What do we check here? So we are still T, and here we check right after writes. I think we also need to check right after reads. And I'm not sure why the book doesn't mention them. Maybe we can figure it out here. Yeah, I think we still need to check right after read. So what we need to check here? We need to check we need to check if there is an earlier transaction U as before that has validated exactly the same condition as before. It has not finished writing yet. And therefore, its rights may interfere with our rights, and that's bad. So we just check this. But I realize we also need to check the write set of T with the read set of U. It never occurred this to me, but the book I'm sure it doesn't mention. It only mentions these two cases. And it's not captured on the previous slide, right? Nope. This checks the read set of T with the write set of U, but we also need to check the write set of T with the read set of U.
But if T validates after U, right? If T validates after U, then it shouldn't matter to you whatever T writes, should it?
If T validates after U, right. So we never need to check for that. Let me actually draw a diagram here. So that case is taken care of by the condition that all the reads are done before the validations and the validation is done before the writes. So here is how that would look like. So we need to have our transaction T with the three phases, read, validate, write. And we need to have a conflict between it and U, and the conflict I was trying to capture is here between these two. But at the same time, I'm looking at those transactions U that come before T. So its validation time must be before this validation time. There is this dependency. Let me make it in blue. We have this dependency here between val of U and val of T. So it can never happen that some of these writes happen after, no, that some of these reads happen after these writes because of this dependency. Every transaction U whose validation time comes before the validation time of T is guaranteed to have finished its reads before we start doing the writes. So this is why the book doesn't check for this case. It's not needed.
So then this is the same logic as the previous one. It's going to try to pretend that the entire transaction occurred atomically at the validation time, and conflicts are anything that makes it impossible to pretend that.
Exactly. It's the same principle. It fakes a serial execution in which the validation time is the order of the execution. Okay, so we finally finished what we had for last time. We still have about 13 minutes before the break. I think I would like to start because the beginning of the new lecture, I should tell you what we have prepared for today is much more lightweight, except for some stuff towards the end, which has to deal with hash tables. Surprise, surprise. There are some subtle things about hash tables. I'd like to start now, even if it's almost time for the break, because I think we can advance pretty quickly with the first few slides. It's not that easy to switch, but here we go. So today, we will start discussing the internals of a query processor. And we will discuss how data is organized on disk. That's pretty easy and fluffy. And then we will discuss indexes. And essentially we covered chapters 8, 10, and 11. I couldn't understand the purpose of chapter 9 in the book. It's essentially a repetition of what's in the other chapters. Okay, so I don't need to argue why we have to store data on disk, because that's where it's persistent. And you know that disks are much bigger and also much slower than main memory. So when we will discuss performance and when we will evaluate the performance of various algorithms, we will always examine the number of disk reads and writes. This is the dominating term in any running time. But right now we just worry about how to organize a disk. And let me skip these things. So recall from what we discussed a few lectures ago that every disk is partitioned into blocks. The blocks have a fixed size, and we can think of them as being numbered. They have a sequential number, and the blocks are simply distributed on the disk consecutively. First on the same track, they are consecutive. Then you move to the next platter, so the block on the next on the same cylinder, and then you move to the next track. What this means is that if you're reading blocks consecutively, if you're doing a sequential scan, then you should get the highest throughput possible that a disk can deliver. It's a simple concept. So the issue that we are discussing today is how to go from this logical data model in which data is stored in a table to disks where data is organized in these rigid blocks. It's not rocket science, but it's worthwhile to examine some of the issues. And there are three issues that we need to discuss. How do we keep track of the free blocks on disk? How do we represent the records inside the blocks? And finally, how do we organize the records themselves? How do we represent the fields inside the records? How do you keep track of free blocks on disk? What do the operating systems do? And I don't know. I'm asking you. I mean, I know gazillions of ways to keep track of free memory, but I do not know exactly what the operating systems do to keep track of the free blocks on disk. Does anyone know? Yes.
NTFS, I think, uses linked lists of free blocks. You can also use bitmaps of free blocks.
Right. So these are the two methods that I also know. Either linked lists of free blocks or bitmaps, and that's what I have here. Oops, where is it? So one way to keep track of free blocks is to put them in a list of free space. So which means that if you need a new block, what do? You go to the first one, and since it's doubly linked, you can remove it from the list. It's very cheap, and you just assign it to the used one, to the used set. When you free a page, then you do the opposite action. Or we can have like a bitmap, like a central data structure that keeps track of every block on disk, whether it's free or whether it's occupied, and we only need one bit for every block. Which method is better for databases? It's not a good answer, but one method has an obvious advantage that the other one doesn't have. That is, we really care about in data management and databases.
Bitmap, you can find consecutive blocks on the disk.
Exactly. And bitmap, it's easy to find consecutive blocks on disk. You need a big chunk. We need 1,000 blocks for a big table. You look in the bitmap where these 1,000 consecutive blocks are. And if you can't find 1,000, then you can even imagine more sophisticated algorithms that look for the best way to allocate blocks for such a big table. With a free list, it is much harder. Okay. The second issue that I'd like to discuss is how, so now we have the blocks that belong to a file. How do we store the records inside the blocks? Well, it's not a big deal. We need to simply store multiple records in every block. The assumption is always that a record is less than a block, so we can always fit a record in a block. This assumption may be broken, but that's like more like the exception. Let's discuss here the general case. So records can be of two kinds. They can be fixed lengths or variable lengths. In most cases, they are of variable lengths, but you can imagine it's more efficient with fixed lengths. One important idea at this point, that we need to bring up at this point, is that every record has a record ID. Think of it as a pointer. So if you want to go to the table of products, you want to fetch a certain record, the way to do this is to know its record ID. It's like a pointer. Why do we need record IDs in databases? Why do we need pointers in databases?
Indices can point to them. Index entry can point to this.
For two reasons. One is for indexes. The indexes, they have no choice but to point to the actual record ID.
Foreign keys, maybe.
Foreign keys. Well, how should I phrase it? A foreign key is not an RID, but it's a key value, right? Should that be substituted with an RID?
Well, we usually create an index on a foreign key, then we have a mapping.
Exactly. Usually for create an index on that key, you know, you create an index on the key, and then you have a mapping. So no, we always keep foreign keys and it's in their native format. Yes?
For locking key.
Yeah, if you want to lock a record, actually for both aspects of the for both roles of the transaction manager, you need them. For locking, you refer to a record by its RID, or in the locks, when you if you have a logical recovery manager, then you need to record RIDs, and Aries actually has physical elements for the redo portion, so there when it writes the old value of the entire block, but for the undo portion, it has a logical logging. So there it stores the value of the old record. And it does so because it also wants to do the rollback using the log. And that's much easier to do if it has logical entries corresponding to records, not to pages, not to blocks. Okay, so we need this RID. What is the RID? Well, let's see how pages are actually organized to store multiple records. If the records are fixed, then we can represent them like this. But now, what happens if we have to delete a page? If we delete this page, no, I said the page, I'm sorry, I'm tired. What happens if we have to delete a record?
Shift everything backwards.
Then you have to shift everything. What would be a natural pointer? What would be a natural RID here? If it's a block number, and the offset or the record number, right? You assume you know how big the records are and the record number, which means that once you delete, you can't do your favorite trick. You can't take the last one and move it here. Actually, you can't even delete it. You have to keep it there. And in database systems, this is what actually happens. When a record is deleted, it's never deleted. It's marked as being deleted. So let's see how this works for variable length records. If the records are of variable length, which is more like the common case, then we would have a header in each page. There is a block header. That contains, among others, contains local pointers to the beginning of each record. When a record is deleted, we can reclaim its physical space here, but we still need to maintain its header. So this one remains. And then it's called a tombstone. It receives a special value which says, I was a record, but I'm no longer here. So if there is any pointer to this record, maybe in the log, then you know, or maybe in the index, you know this is not a valid record anymore. It has been deleted. Good. And the last thing to discuss is how do we organize the actual records. Well, every record must store several fields. And we organize them pretty much similar to the way we organized blocks. So, for example, if we have to store such a table, product of PID, name, description, and maker. If we are lucky and all these fields are of fixed length, then we just organize the record like this. We know the offset of each field. So if you need to access, let's say, the description, then you examine the catalog, you see the length of the fields that come before description, and you know exactly where to go to find description. But if the fields are of variable lengths, then you need, let me skip this, then you need, again, a record header, which will have pointers to the beginning of the variable length fields. If we have a variable length field, which is null, how many bytes do we need for that field? 0 bytes. However, in the header, we still need a slot for that for that field. We can't ignore it, because in the header we must have a one-to-one mapping between the entries in the header and the fields in the record. Okay, so you probably wondered what happens to those big records that we might want to store. Here's a story. We can't have humongously big records. Oracle has a limit of, if I remember well, 2048 attributes, I think. And also there is a limit on the size of the record, which I don't remember what that was. But if you do have to store a very large object, then you do this using a blob or a clob. Blob stands for binary large object. It's something you declare when you create a table. You say that a certain attribute is of type blob, and then you can store there anything, an image, a video, whatever large object. In this class, we already encountered something that's very close to a blob. XML, exactly. That is like a blob, but it's not a blob. It's a new type because it supports certain operations, very expensive operations and very powerful ones, but it behaves like a blob. They have to be stored separately, and blobs, they actually don't support any operation. You can't use them in a where construct. You can only return them. You want the video, you get the video, but you can't query on all the records that have a video with a certain property. Okay, I think I'd like to stop here and take a break. 8 minutes until 8 o'clock, and then we discuss essentially indexes. I'm going to move ahead and discuss indexes. We move directly to indexes. So indexes are crucial in database systems. For every table that we create, we probably have at least one index, if not more than one. Now, here is some terminology about indexes. The index is essentially a table that stores like a key value, a quote key, which is not exactly a key like in the tables, but it has a similar role, and some associated information about that key, usually a pointer to a record in a file. So the key is called the search key, and I should emphasize it's not the key of a table, but it's still called a key. And this search key can be an attribute. It can be a collection of attributes. You can have an index of multiple attributes. It can even be an expression. We can index, for example, if you have a date time, you can index on the year, just the year. You write an expression that extracts the date time from that field and construct an index on just the year. So for every key value K, think of it as being the year or the name or whatever, we associate some so-called data entries, K star. Think of K star as being the pointer to the record, or maybe the record itself, or maybe all the pointers to all the records that have that key K. And I'll come back to this a few slides later. Now, indexes, they come in various shapes and forms, and here is a not exhaustive list of their types. They can be clustered, unclustered, primary, secondary, dense, or sparse. What do they mean? The most important terminology is this one here, clustered and unclustered. A clustered index is an index in which record entries in the data that have close values of the index key are also close together. That's a clustered index. An unclustered is the other one, in which they are not close together. Let me put it differently. If you're indexing on an attribute A, and if your file is sorted by the attribute A, then you have a clustered index. That's a basic intuition. Then you can organize that index specially. There is only one clustered index for each table, and that's the most efficient one. But you can have as many unclustered indexes as you wish. Another terminology is primary-secondary index. Sometimes this means just clustered, unclustered. This is unfortunately not a standard terminology. Sometimes people, when they say primary index, they think of the clustered index. And when they say secondary index, they think of an unclustered index. But sometimes they mean something else. Sometimes they mean that a primary index is an index that contains the primary key. That contains a primary key. In theory, you could have multiple primary indexes, but they probably don't make too much sense because every entry in that index contains already the primary key. And then a secondary index would be another one that does not contain a primary key. We will use essentially the clustered and unclustered terminology. And if we call them primary, secondary, we refer to this clustered and unclustered. They can be dense or sparse. I will show you what this means. And there are two data structures that store indexes, B plus trees, or sometimes they can be hash tables, quite rarely though. And some other times there are other data structures that are meant for high dimensional data. They're called R trees. And we are not going to cover them in class. Okay, so let's see clustered, unclustered. Here's the difference. The typical index that we will keep in mind is a B tree, B plus tree. And we will study it today. How many people here know B trees? Almost everyone. Good. So that's a B tree. It's a triangle, okay? And we will see the inside of the triangle. But the important thing is that on the leaves, there are this important things for us, the data entries. Now, in a clustered index, these data entries are the records. So finally, the last level of the tree, the picture is not that good, but this is the last level of the tree. And they are the data entries. So essentially, the B plus tree is interwoven with the actual file. In an unclustered index, there is a separation. Here, this line makes sense. There is a B tree that has this last level sitting right here. And then there are pointers to the data records, and these pointers go all over the place. That's an unclustered index. So when we discuss for a couple of slides, I'm going to represent the index like this. Think of this here as being a B tree. And these are the leaves of the B tree. And I'm going to examine what happens at the leaves. So let me erase that. Here is the way to think about a clustered dense index. This is the index key. This is K. And then K star would be either the pointer to that record or even the record itself. So how do we use an index? For example, if we search for the record with the key 60, then we would use a B tree to quickly retrieve a block that contains 60. And from here we find the pointer that leads us to the block that contains the record with the key 60. It's very straightforward. A clustered index can be sparse, which means that it only contains one key from each block. Since the keys are now sorted, it can afford to store just the smallest key in each block. For example, if we are searching for 60, how do we proceed in this case? You find this block. Here is where 60 should be, but it's not there. So what do you do then?
Smaller.
Go to the smaller one, which says 50, follow this pointer to the block, and now here you find 60. And if you don't find it there, you know it doesn't exist. Okay. The unclustered index looks like this. There is the index structure, and now every single key has a pointer to the record, to the block, and the record where that key occurs. We don't necessarily need a pointer to the actual record. Once we reach a block, the rest of the operation is not that expensive. We can read the records. Okay. A short discussion about what is actually stored in the index, the data entry in each index. And there are three alternatives. What is K star? It can be the actual data record, and that only happens for clustered indexes. If the index is unclustered, then we have two choices, and they make a difference if this attribute is not unique. If the attribute is not unique, then we can either store multiple occurrences of this key, and each occurrence has a single RID, a single pointer to one record with that key. Or we can store the key only once, and then we have a list of records with pointers to that key. Let me show you on a picture. So here, for example, we might have 10 and 20 repeated, similarly for 30. In the second alternative, for every record that has the key 10, we have a separate index entry, and there is a pointer to that record. So this is K, and that would be K star, a single pointer. In the third alternative, K star is a list. So here we have 10, but now there is a list of pointers. So this alternative makes the actual index easier to organize, because we have B tree with unique occurrences of the key. That's something we understand and know how to organize. But now we have to manage lists, which sometimes is if the lists are long, then this is less efficient than managing a single pointer. Okay, any questions so far about index organizations? A few thoughts about how to use an index. The basic operation on an index is scan. Scan is a lookup is a special case of a scan. It says scan all the records with a certain value of a key, and that's what the index can support very effectively. If the index is clustered, then an index scan is the same thing as a table scan. But if it's unclustered, and if we really need to scan multiple index entries, then the performance degrades pretty quickly, because we need to read different blocks from different for different portions of the different places on disk. So let's examine more closely how an index can be used. So suppose we have a table, people. I forgot to write the schema here. And it has names. It has salary and age and other attributes. And suppose we have two indexes, one on salary and one on age. So let's look at the first query. It's very straightforward. So this says go to people and find the names of those persons whose salary is 25. How would we use the index here? We just go to the salary index, which is a B3, and we scan for we search the index for the key 25. Maybe we find a single key with pointers to all the records that have salary 25, should be more like age, but anyway, let's make it 25k. Okay, now it's a more realistic salary. So we find all the people with pointers to all the records with salary 25k, or maybe the B3 is such that it has many entries equal to 25. So then we actually need to traverse all these entries in the B3, follow their pointers. Let's look at the range query. So now we look for age between 20 and 30. Again, it's an operation that's supported by the B3, and this is why we call it a scan, because we scan all the entries in the B3 whose keys are between 20 and 30. But here is a more interesting usage. Look at this example. How can you answer this query? Select distinct age from people. You can answer this query by only scanning the index. Mm-hmm. We can scan the age index and retrieve all the age values. This is a dense index that will contain all entries for age, and we can answer the query completely without even touching the big table. We only reach the index. That's called an aggressive use of an index. You can imagine even slightly more complicated queries where this is still possible by just combining two indexes. Okay, at this point, I'd like to switch to the demo. So, Rod, I can do my part here. Oops. Start. So far, so good. So I'd like to show you how indexes are used on SQL Server. And also to give you a taste of the kind of the query that you have to write for the last homework. So for that, I need to go here. Okay. Can you read the query on the screen?
Yes.
Not really. Maybe I should make it. Is there a quick way to make this bigger?
Control and scroll the mouse, maybe.
Control. I don't have a mouse.
Well,
The view window view.
The view menu in the top. File and view.
File?
It's under tools options, I think.
Yeah.
But you have to open it before your windows.
In options.
It's just the fonts and colors.
But in the environment, the third item from the top.
Oh, there you go, yeah.
Third item from the top.
Left side, right under where it's highlighted.
This one?
No.
It's environment.
Very top.
Fonts and colors.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
Fonts and colors.
Fonts and colors, right. Oh, thank you. And now I need to make the size bigger, like 16. Good. So now you should be able to see it, right?
Yep.
So this is your familiar database, the IMDb movie database, and here is a simple query. Select star from movie where year is 1990. Let's execute it. Now, one feature of SQL Server that at this point you should start playing with is this one, which displays the estimated execution plan. So this shows you how the query is evaluated, but this is not good. It's not what I wanted to show you. I'm kind of stealing my thunder. So don't look at that. Let's make a small change. I'm going to look for all movies made in 1900 because the database also has movies from 1900, and I get them. So now we look at the query plan, and I don't know how to make this font bigger, but I'm going to read what it says. This is a tree. We're going to start studying execution trees next time. It says that at the leaf there is an index seek. It's an index seek on year index. We have an index called year index on the year of the movie in the IMDb database. And what this operator does is to seek in that index the entry corresponding to 1900. Okay? So what will the index return? A set of K stars, those mysterious pointers. Now in SQL Server, I can tell you this by just examining this plan, these pointers are not our record IDs, but they're actually primary keys. And the primary key in movie, if you remember, is called ID, the movie ID. So what this index returns is a collection of IDs, all the IDs of all the movies made in 1900. And now comes a new operation called the join. This is, if you hover the mouse over it, it's called a nested loop join. We're going to discuss this next time. It's essentially, it takes every ID that comes from the index and sends it to the other operator. What is that? Why do we need a join here? Let me ask you this. There is no join in the SQL query. Why does SQL Server decide to run a join?
For the rest of the attributes.
Sorry?
Did you get the rest of the attributes?
No, it only asks for, it looks for the rest of the attributes. Let me, what's the title of the movie? Do you remember? Is it name or title? Is it movie name? Let me do this. It's name. So let me just return the movie name. So what does the plan do now? The plan is the same plan. There is still a join, even though we only need a name. Where did the join come from? That's my question.
The index table and the fields table.
Exactly. It's a natural way to explain what happens with these indexes. We need to look up the secondary index first, the unclustered. That takes 1900 and gives us a list of IDs, of keys. We need to run those keys into the primary index, and this is what the other operator is. This is a clustered index seek that looks in the B tree associated to ID and fetches all the entries there. And finally, there is a select which only returns the name. You should have say somewhere that this is a name. So that's a query plan, and at this point we should feel comfortable that we understood how this simple query. Now let me make a small change here. Write 1990. So if I execute this, we're getting all the movies in 1990. But if I look at the query plan, it's different. So let's see what it says. There is no more year index. This says a clustered index scan. And this is the main index, it's the index, the ID primary index. This is what it says here. Who can explain to me what happened? Why did it find all the movies in 1900 using a complicated plan that actually used the index we were expecting?
Return very many rows.
Exactly. It has to deal with, there are very two interesting things here. The first is that for 1990, there are lots of movies made in 1990, right? So if you were to take an unclustered index, find the entry for 1990, and that points you to gazillions of pointers of records sitting on disk, and now you have to read them one by one, because of the random access, this time will actually take longer than reading the whole table sequentially.
Why wouldn't it sort them? Well, because they're keys.
Because they're keys, yeah.
No, but the other one is a clustered image. If we just sort the keys, they would have to be fine, right? Because they're movie IDs, so you could sort them, and you know the primary index is clustered, so it would work.
You could sort them, it doesn't do so. So probably after you do the math, it may turn out that the cost of sorting plus the expected gain is too small to make it worthwhile. And the second thing is, but at this point I hope is clear, with an unclustered index, if there are too many records that we need to access, it doesn't make sense to use it. It makes more sense to do a complete sequential scan of the table. And the second interesting thing is, how did SQL Server know that movies in the 1900s are rare and far in between, and 1990s there are many?
Statistics.
It uses statistics. It has a histogram that tells it for every value of the year how many records there are. And this histogram is updated, and this is what it does. It uses such statistics. If there are too many years, then it will bucketize them. If this were not about movies, but it were about... but years are not that many in the history of humankind, right? But if there were like 100,000 entries as opposed to just 100, then it would divide them into buckets. And it will still try to capture some statistics about the data to be able to make these hard decisions. Okay, any more questions about these two simple queries before I switch back to the lecture? Yes?
So I kind of played with this earlier on, and there's an option to display the estimated execution plan and one which displays the actual execution plan. And most of it is the same. Sometimes there are subtle differences. Does it matter which one should we rely on when we're trying to tune these things or make decisions on its behavior?
So he mentions a second button here, which is the actual execution plan. I played with it a little bit this morning. What I noticed is that this is an on-off button. So once you click it on, then when you execute, you also see the execution plan. So my reading was that it's the same thing, but one shows you only the plan, while the other one, when you turn it on, then when it executes, it will also show you the plan.
It was my understanding that SQL Server actually, as it executes the query, once it's completed some of it, if the execution time is wildly out of sync with the log, it'll believe the execution instead of the statistics.
I see. You're right. So after it executes a query, we can actually report on the true running time of each operator. While if it only computes a plan, if I click here, then it doesn't have the actual running time because it hasn't executed the query, so it only gives you estimates. So maybe that's a difference.
I thought I read somewhere that it takes into account actual server load as well, like the actual execution plan. Like if
okay.
Something being accessed to something else.
It could be that it you optimize it under different assumptions. Okay. So I'd like to move back now to the lecture. And for that, I'm going to close this. So you already see the lecture. But it's not on my machine yet. Good. So in the remaining of this lecture, and I realize now we really have enough time, so we will finish this. I want to discuss B+ trees, which is something that most of you already know, and then hash tables. Some advanced uses, advanced types of hash tables. So B+ trees. Everybody knows what a binary search tree is. It's a tree which has a key at every node, and all the keys that are less than this key will go to the left, and all the keys that are bigger will go to the right. That's a search tree. We don't use a search tree in databases, and that's the reason is that a node in a search tree is very small. It just has a single key. In databases, we would like to have a node which is as wide as a block. So when we read a block, we should use that information as aggressively as possible. So the idea behind B-trees is to make one node equal one block. B+ trees, in addition to this, create a linked list of all the leaves. And that's the only difference. And also, the useful information in a B+ tree is on the leaves. While in a B tree, in general, it can be anywhere and on the internal nodes. So here are the basics of a B+ tree. There is a parameter which different books denote in different ways. I'm going to denote it with D, call it the degree, and this parameter says that every node has between D and 2D keys. So the maximum number of keys that you can store in a node in a B tree is even, is always even. So here are the keys of a node, and the node has a number of pointers that's one larger than the number of keys. Think of these pointers as sitting between the keys. So there is a pointer to all the keys less than 30, a pointer to all the keys between 30 and 120, and so on. And finally, the leaves are organized the same way, with the only difference is that now the pointers are to actually records. These are the key stars, which if there are a single pointer, then it's easy to imagine what this means. If there are lists, then this might require some additional layer of indirection. And in addition, we have this link, this pointer to the next leaf. Okay, so here is a B tree, a B plus tree. The animation doesn't work, and I had beautiful animation here. So please try this at home. I won't be able to show you the animation. So what is interesting about this B plus 3? D is 2, which means that every node has between 2 and 4 keys. Every node except the root. The root can have as few as a single key, but never more than 4 keys. That's the rule in B trees. So look, this node has 2 keys, this node has 3 keys, some nodes have 4 keys, and life is good. That's how a B plus 3 can be organized. In addition, look at the leaves. The leaves are chained in a linked list. Okay, so my animation was illustrating how to find a certain key. How do we find the key 40? Well, we start from the root, and since 40 is less than 80, we have to go left. Since 40 is between 20 and 60, we have to go follow this pointer. And we finally reach a leaf, and here is 40. And therefore, the corresponding record is right to its left, is here. That's how we find 40. What happens if we want all the keys between 40 and 82? Let me write it this way. How do we proceed?
We find 40 and then follow the pointers in the linked list.
Exactly. We find 40 and then we read them sequentially following the pointers in the linked list. That's why B plus 3 is organized by chaining all the leaves in a list. Now there is a subtle distinction between the B plus trees as you see them on this slide and the B trees that you might have studied in a data structures class. And that distinction has to deal with where the actual data lives. The actual data here lives on the leaves. For example, look at 60. This is not the real value 60. This is just a guide for the search. The actual 60 is this one. This is the actual data value. So when we are searching for 60, we may find 60 in between. In this case, we have to consider our key as being greater than 60 because this is how we break ties. And but the actual value is on the leaves. Okay, so some words about the design. How large should we choose D? The slide gives you the details, but it doesn't show you the high level idea. What dictates the choice of D? The math that we're doing here will ensure what?
That we fully utilize the block.
We try to make D as big as possible without exceeding the size of the block. And this depends on, Rod, what happened? We lost the screen here. Here we go. So this illustrates the point. We need to know the size of the key. I assume it's 4 bytes, which means it's more like an integer. We have a B tree of integers. We need to know the size of the pointers. 8 bytes is pretty typical. And we need to know the block size, which is usually bytes. It's usually bigger than 4 kilobytes. It's like 8 or 16 kilobytes. So then, this is the worst case size of a node, right here. And this has to be less than the size of a block. And this gives us a D of 170. Now, the book ventures, I don't know how to put it, they come up with these numbers. I don't know where they got them from, but I use them in all the courses I teach. They seem to be pretty instructive, even if they are, if we don't know how they were collected. There's a typical order of a B plus tree in practice is about 100, which means it can store between 100 and 200 keys. The typical fill factor is 67%.
This is no. only for the leaf level, right? This is not for the index nodes. Because for index nodes, you can have, I mean, you're not storing the data, you're only storing keys and pointers. So if your data is bigger than key plus two pointers, then your index node can be a lot denser in terms of the number of keys that it contains than a leaf node.
Yes, so the index node...
But 99% of all the nodes will be leaf nodes.
Exactly. I'm saying the order of an index node is probably bigger than the order of a leaf node, because the data record is probably bigger than an index entry.
I see. So you're saying that a leaf node can hold more keys than D.
I'm saying I think there are two Ds. One D for the index node,
okay.
One different D for the leaf node.
It might be. I don't remember reading this anywhere, but it makes sense. I can imagine adjusting the algorithm to do this, and I agree that the leaf has a different structure than the internal nodes, and this mass here assumes that they have the same structure. These numbers here from the book, if I remember correctly, they don't specify if the fill factor is for the leaf nodes or the internal nodes. But the internal nodes, they also have a fill factor which is between 50% and 100%, right? And actually the leaf can have a much lower fill factor. It can have a single key out of 2D. But this is what they cite, 67% fill factor, whatever that means. Average fan out is 133. Here is an important thing that I would like you to remember. How many leaves can we reach with a B tree that has one level? Let's start with one level. If it's fan out, it's 133. Then we can reach 133 leaves, which means how many records? If each of them has 133 entries, then 133 square records. But if the depth is 4 instead of 1, well, then I think should be to the power 5. The point is we get a humongous number, right? Which means that in practice, B trees have depths less than or equal to 4. That's the depth of a B tree. Which means that with 4 disk accesses, you can get any data item. This contrasts with what you learned in data structures, where they tell you what is the running time of this, of a search operation on a search tree with n nodes, with n keys.
Log n.
So they would say it's O of log base 2 of n. This is what they tell you in algorithm data structures. In databases, we tell you it's 4. And the reason it's 4 is because the base changes. It's actually base 133. And when you do the math, once you go beyond 4, it doesn't, n is too big. We don't have, we can't have such big n.
Can you keep first node in memory or something? Make it 3?
Yes, that's the second idea I'd like to make here. The sizes of these levels increases exponentially, of course. So it makes a lot of sense to keep the root. Definitely, you better keep it in main memory. Okay. So you already save one discrete. Maybe you often have enough room to store the second level in main memory, which means out of these 4 reads, you actually only need 2 to access any data item. That's how powerful B plus 3s are. They're very, very effective. Okay. Let me see. time machine, I think. No, I think we can have a more interesting discussion once we discuss operations. So the two operations that we need to understand in details on B plus on B trees are insertions and deletions. How are these handled? So let's actually take an example and discuss it. We want to insert 19 here. Where does 19 go in this B plus tree? In the first leaf. So we can put it right here. We search for 19, we follow this path, we discover it belongs right here, and that's where we put it, and we're happy. Now the next thing is, I'd like to insert 25. Where does 25 belong?
Second.
In the second leaf, right here. So it's full. So now we need to examine the algorithm for inserting into a B plus tree. So let's examine it. It's much easier to understand if we actually draw the node with 25 sitting there. We don't have space for it, but if we were to implement it, it's almost cleaner if we actually allocate a node which is one bigger and insert the key there and start doing the split afterwards. Once we have inserted it, now this node is too big, so we need to split it. So we split it into, and this is shown here, this is the middle. So it's going to be split something like this. Right, let me go back. So we will create two nodes, one with 25 and 20, and the other with these keys, 30, 40, and 50. Which means that this single child of the parent now will be replaced with two children to these two nodes. What is the key separating these two nodes? We need to add a new key here. What is that key?
30.
It's exactly 30, the key in between. And actually in B trees the picture is much nicer, because 30 is actually extracted from here and migrates to the parent. In B plus trees we do keep 30 over there. So 30 stays here, but it's also inserted here. So now we were lucky, because this node let me see what comes next. No, it's deletion. So we were lucky, because we had room for 30 here. But what happens if this node became full? We split, and then we need to add a new key to the root, right? But what happens if the root becomes full? Then we split it, we create a new root, and how many keys will that new root have? Just one single key. This is why in a B tree the rule is that the root may have as few as a single key. Let's make the math for the nodes in between. A node is full when it has 2D keys. If we try to insert a new key into this, then it will have how many keys? 2D plus 1. We take one, we send it to the parent, and the two children, except if it's where it leaves, the two children will have how many keys?
D.
So we get D, and one which goes to the parent. Which means that every internal node will never have less than D keys. And in a B plus tree, one of them actually has D plus one keys. So this is why the rule is that a node can have between D and 2D keys, except if it's a root, when it has between 1 and 2D keys. B plus trees are beautiful data structures. Let's examine a deletion. So suppose we want to delete 30. So this is a simple case. We just find 30. It's right here. And we delete it. And we still have two keys sitting in this leaf. And that this means that we are allowed to keep them there. And that's the end of the story. 30 is just deleted. And we have finished the deletion. There is a question here. Notice that 30 is also used on an intermediate node. In a regular B tree, 30 only occurs once. It might be in an internal node, but that's where it, I mean, it's just a data value. So when you delete it, it's gone. But here, 30 may occur on internal nodes just to guide the search. So, what are the options now? What can we do with the 30? We could replace it with 40, or I would say we could leave it unchanged. It is still a correct guide for the rest of the tree. It's probably much easier to leave it unchanged, which means that there is no guarantee in general whether the keys, whether the internal keys in the B plus tree actually occur in the data. You have to go all the way to the leaves to figure out what's in the data. Okay, that was a simple case. Now let's see, so 30 may change to 40 or not. Let's delete now 25.
Just a quick question. So does it move all the data items to the left?
In the previous example, no, we just replace it with 40. And there is nothing to move.
Well, 30 was there, so we deleted it put 40 there.
But the child moved.
You mean the child? You moved the 40 and 50 over. Is what he's asking.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you. I mean, you need some array here in each node, where you need to know where the actual values are and where the free space is. I assume you can organize it also with a header with pointers, but I don't think it makes sense. You want an array with fast access into the array. Okay. So deletions had insertions only had one case when the node splits. Deletions have two cases. We need to examine both of them. The first is illustrated here. We delete 25, and now we can't leave it like this. Because this leaf now becomes true empty. It's not allowed to have a single key. What would you do?
19.
Take 19 and move it over here. This makes sense, but we need to do something else.
Update the parent.
Also update the parent. What moves to the parent? 19 actually moved to the parent. This is called a rotation, because in a B tree, these values are distinct, and what happens is that this key goes here, and that key goes there. Now the logic is slightly different, because the leaves have values while the internal nodes have keys. So that's shown here. Here is a rotation. And we must update the 20, which I think is shown right here.
Why is it important that we do that? Why can't you just leave 20 by itself?
What happens if you leave 20 here?
No, I mean in the leaf node, at the lowest level.
Yeah, this arrow, of course, the arrows only point to the beginning of the block. An arrow means a pointer to a block.
No, he's saying, why not allow the node to just have one entry?
Why can't
you just
leave it less than D?
Yeah. Basically. Why can't you leave it just less than D? It's a good question. Can you? Well, it's hard to say if something goes wrong before examining all the operations, but my best guess is that nothing goes wrong. You can still maintain the B tree. Even if you allow nodes to be less full, but
you
don't like this.
Multiple merges, yeah.
Sorry.
when you merge, you still may not get into a helpful. Yeah, it's just weird. Because you're wasting space.
You waste space. That's the reason. We want the B-tree to be compact. If we start wasting space, then that magic number, four disk reads to get to the data item, may soon degrade. Once you are in a position in which every node has a single key, then the fan-out is no longer 133. Then the fan-out is 2. So this is why we actually work hard to keep the nodes at least half full. That's the invariant in B plus trees. So does this make sense?
Not really, but okay. I'll believe you. I guess the way I would look at it is if you know that that key existed, the previous values were in that block, then odds are that those values can come back again. So pre-allocating space on the disk so you can have that storage available would actually be a performance increase. You'd waste disk space, yes, but you wouldn't have to deal with shifting keys around when you got those indexes reinserted later on.
So let me see how to articulate this. What you're advocating is a speculative policy in which you temporarily allow nodes to be under full with the expectation that they will be filled up again, right?
Correct.
The problem with this is that you still need some guarantees that later on they will be filled. Because otherwise, if you don't have any guarantees, then what you anticipate might happen may actually not happen. So there might be no new insertion into that node. And then you get a performance problem.
But your performance should never be worse than it was when the system was full, right? So suppose you added, a million records, and then you deleted 100,000 of them, or even half of them. Your performance should be the same as it was when it had a million records, right?
Right.
You just didn't get the benefit from having trimmed it back.
Yeah, but this is not okay. So he has the following observation, which is very good. If the number of records that you had evolves like this. Let's examine this. This is time. This is the number of records in the B-tree and in your database. Initially, you insert and you reach 1 million. And now you start deleting. And you don't worry about these rebalancing. So you allow the nodes to become mostly empty. How bad can the performance be around this point?
Same as the peak.
And his point is, it can't be any worse than the peak. Right?
Yeah.
But this also suggests what can happen next.
Yeah, you add more, you go back to a million.
You add more, actually, you can stay here and only add one record and delete one record. And keep the same number. But if you do this for a long period of time, then you're in trouble.
Are you?
Think about it this way. This B plus 3 might be the amount on the dollar amount for accounts. Like you want to retrieve quickly all accounts with a certain dollar amount or with a dollar amount in a certain range. The dollar value updates every time you get 20 bucks from an ATM or whenever you deposit. So you get this phenomenon in which entries are deleted and updated all the time. So the number of updates may be much larger, orders of magnitudes larger than the total number of records at your peak.
Sure, but if the tree is sparse, then your adds will not split nodes, right?
If the tree is sparse, then the adds will not split nodes. This is correct.
You can be adding at a different dollar range, right? So maybe there's, maybe there's like some whole bunch of rich guys started adding money to their accounts, even though they weren't there before, and now that side of the B-tree is now splitting all over the place,
yeah.
Whereas the poor guy's area is all, single node in a single entry in a single node, and you increase the total number. Maybe you had to add another level now for no reason.
So the interesting thing is that actually these kind of analyses are interesting to make for various B-trees to see how they behave under certain insertions. So suppose for example you have inserted values 1, 2, 3 up to 1, 2, 3, what am I writing here, up to n, and now you do the following experiment. You delete 1 and insert n plus 1, delete 2, insert n plus 2. How does the B-tree evolve? Well, if you apply the rules correctly, then it will always be balanced, it will always be at least half full, and things go okay. Once you start changing the rules of the B-tree, then it depends. It's a case that can be analyzed and see how it behaves. The only analysis that I saw was, but I'm going to tell you on the next slide, because I need to show you the next thing. So let me read this. Let's assume for the moment, although some of you at Microsoft disagree, that we must do this rebalancing in order to keep the tree, in order to ensure that the tree is always balanced and is always at least half full. So let's examine the last case of a deletion. What happens if we delete 40 here? So now we can't borrow from a neighbor because both neighbors are empty. So then we do something called a merge. We take two nodes. One is at a minimum, so it has d keys. The other has one key less, so it has d minus one keys. And we merge them into a single node, and we also take a key from the parent. And again, this is much cleaner in the case of B trees as opposed to B plus trees, because then we get D plus D minus 1, and plus 1 key is exactly 2D. In our case, we get 2D minus 1 keys. So how does the resulting tree look like? These two nodes will be merged, and the key 30 that separated them disappears. And that's shown here. Right, this node has disappeared, and the key 30 in between has disappeared. But what happens if this new node becomes now too empty? Then at that level, we need to try a rotation first, if we have enough keys in the neighbors. And if no rotation is possible, then we merge this node with one of its neighbors, in this case is this neighbor, and we take a key away from the root. But what if the root becomes too empty? What if the root had only one key? Sorry? Then that root becomes empty, so we essentially eliminate one level in the B-tree. That's how the B-trees shrink. Okay, so that's a summary on the B-trees. Let me discuss two important things. One is related to that analysis that the comment from Microsoft made me think of. When we insert a key in a B-tree, the leaf might split. The node above might split as well. In the worst case, you can get a chain reaction in which every node on the path from that leaf back to the root splits. When you delete a key, you may get into a situation in which the two leaves have to be merged. Then the nodes above have to be merged. All the way up to the leaf, everything needs to be merged. Can it be the case that you have a sequence of insert-delete statements such that every insert and every delete results in a complete, in the worst case. So insertions, they do a split all the way up to the leaf, and deletions do merge all the way up to the leaf. And the answer is yes, this can happen with a B-tree. You just need to look at the example in some standard textbook. I won't be able to reproduce it right now. But there is a worst case scenario in which this happens. What theoreticians say is that the worst case amortized cost per operation is log n. You're spending log, in the worst case, once you, so in general, when you have many operations on a B-tree, you amortize your total cost by the total number of operations. But because of this bad example, that the amortized cost can be as bad as log n. But there is a slight tweak to B-trees, and they are called no longer B-trees. They are called AB-trees. That does not suffer from this phenomenon. And it's amazingly simple. It allows a node to have between D and two D plus one keys. And actually they call this value A and this value B. As long as B is bigger than twice A, at least one bigger than twice A, then the amortized cost per number of operations is O of 1, is constant. Which means, yeah, occasionally you can have these splits all the way to the leaf, or all the way back to the root, but they will not accumulate. And to my knowledge, databases don't implement this. Probably because that example where the amortized cost is log n is so contrived. So it probably doesn't happen in practice. Okay, so that was a theoretical discussion. I have a second discussion here. Let's think about insertions again. Suppose this were full, so here we have a 55, and we have to insert a key in this node. And therefore we might have to split this, and therefore we might have to split this node, and therefore we might have to split this node. The transaction that does an insertion in a B-tree needs to acquire locks on which nodes? On all the nodes from the root to the leaf. So it acquires these locks, and then it has to see which of them have to split going backwards. And when it finishes, it can release. There is a big problem here. What's a big problem?
Contention at the root.
There is a high contention at the root. No matter what values they read, in what place of the tree, they all need to access the root. Here is a solution. The solution is to aggressively split the root. So the insertion algorithm is modified such that as you're searching for the node where you have to insert, whenever you find a node that's full, you split it. Because you know you will insert. Maybe it's an unnecessary split, but you split it anyway. And then you can release this lock. Move on to the next node. If this one is not full, then you don't have to split it, but you can release a lock. The next one, if it's full, you split it. And then you release a lock, and this way you can immediately release a lock on the higher nodes as you go down the tree. This, with a change from the two-phase locking to the tree protocol, enables B-trees to work efficiently in conjunction with the concurrency control manager. Yes?
And if you rotate, would you need to also do a lock on a neighboring leaf as well?
Yeah, every single touch you need to lock. So, but this is a high-level picture that I drew here, and in practice the details are probably quite hairy. But the idea is there. You do what you have to do at this level, and then you release a lock and move on to the next level. I never heard people talking about merging nodes aggressively. The issue is more with splitting.
If you use timestamps or something that's not locks.
Sorry?
If you use timestamps, then it wouldn't check until you actually try to write to the root.
How do B plus trees work in conjunction with timestamps? I don't know. I don't even know if any database system implements them with timestamps. Again, timestamps can coexist with locks. not that I know how they coexist, but I know that database systems, they do support both simultaneously. So I don't even know if they use anything else besides locks for B plus trees. Does anyone know if B plus trees work with timestamps? Okay, take Phil Bernstein's course to figure out. Although he might not talk about this, he might talk about other things. Okay, so I still want to talk about hash tables. So this finishes the discussion on B-trees. Most indexes are B-trees because they support range queries and because they are so effective. But you can also choose to implement an index as a hash table. And we need to study it anyway because hash tables are a fundamental technique for query processing, much more so than order-based algorithms, than merge-based algorithms. So the basics. A hash table depends on a function, f, that takes a key and maps it to an integer in a range between 0 and n minus 1. N is a parameter that we control. It's the size of the hash table. And this is a quick way to index a key. For example, let's suppose our keys are letters A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And the hash function is such that it maps these keys to what is shown here. E goes to 0, B and F go to 1. Now, how this function is computed, this we won't discuss. We will discuss briefly what makes sense, but we won't go into concrete hash functions. What's important for us is the organization of the hash table, which, if it sits on disk, and that's a default we will consider, then every block becomes a bucket, and it can store a number of keys, in this example, two keys. And every key has to be sent to the bucket with a number given by the hash function. Quite straightforward. B and F, they are together because they collude. And by the way, this is called a collusion. Okay, hash table basics. So, for example, suppose we are searching for A, for the key A. How does the search proceed? First, we compute the hash function on A. We have that hash function. It's a piece of code. And that hash function returns 3. So now we do a direct access to block number 3. And we read that block, and now we inspect, we read linearly all of the keys in this block, and we find that A is right here. And next to A, we have K star, the actual information, the data entry associated to A. Okay, very straightforward. How do we do insertions? Well, if there is enough room in the bucket where we need to insert, we just put it there. What do we do if there is not enough room? We chain. Then we put a pointer. If this one becomes full, then we need another pointer. And what's the problem with hash tables? They may become linear. This is why theoreticians don't quite like them. They like to think about search trees because they have guaranteed properties. Hash tables, they don't have guaranteed properties. But in practice, we can engineer this function well enough such that the hash tables, they don't become linear. They typically have O of 1 constant time access to every key. Okay. However, there is an important parameter that we need to engineer, and that's difficult. And that is N, the size of the hash table. How big should N be? What happens if you want to index, let's say, a table of persons? You want to index on age. How big would you choose N? like 30, maybe 100. Why not 100? It's a small number. So then you have a high chance that every single distinct age ends up in a different bucket. And actually you can use directly age, right? Like it's just a small integer. So you don't even need a hash function. What happens if you want to index on name? Name is varchar of, let's say, 50. What could a hash function be? How would you convert a name into a number between 0 and, let's say, 99, if n is 100?
CRC.
So CRC or sum the ASCII codes and divide by 100, and this is a good way to start computing a hash function. These CRCs are fine. Just mod has some problems, but I'm not. My goal is not to discuss those problems. My goal is to focus on this n. So how big would you choose n in this case? Is 99 okay? Depends. If the table is big, if it has 1 million employees, then 100 is way too small, because then you expect about 1 million divided by 100 employees in each bucket, and that essentially degenerates to a linear list. So then you need a bigger n. In general, what we would like to do is we would like to start with a small n and let it increase over time as we insert new entries. This is especially important when we do query processing, when we compute a join using a hash table, and I'm going to show you this next time. But then we have no clue how to choose n. But what we can do is we can start small and expand it at runtime. So these are there are two particular hash tables that you probably haven't heard of that achieves this. How many people have heard of extensible hash tables and of linear hash tables? Okay, not that many, and I realize I went so slowly that I'm almost out of time. So extensible hash tables. Here is the idea. We need a hash function that returns big numbers, numbers up to 2k minus 1. So our n is a power of 2. And it will be a big power of 2.
What's k?
Think of k as being like 32. So which means that we will be ready to construct a hash table of up to n to 2 to the power 32. But we will not start with such a big n. Instead, we will start with a much smaller n, a much smaller power of 2, and we will extend it. So here is a data structure that we need. The idea is that we only look at the last significant bits of the key, of the hash function, essentially. For example, if the hash functions are four and seven, and I'm going to call them keys, although they're actually their hash values written by the hash function applied to the keys. Then we are going to look only at the last bit initially, because n is 2, which means it's 2 to the power 1, which means we only look at one single bit returned by the hash function. So here is the initial data structure. We have a hash table with two entries, and here are the keys fitting in the two buckets. We insert. When we insert a new value, how do we know where to insert it, in which bucket? We look at what? We look at the last bit, which is 1, so this wants to go right here. Let's create an overflow. So now we want to insert this value, which wants to go in the same place, but there is no more room for it. This is where we extend n. In an extensible hash table, when we extend n, we always double it. So now we, instead of having two entries like we had here, we will double it to 4. These were the initial 2, and they were only looking at these values, but now we double them to 4. And look what we do to this block. We go over its keys and we look at the previous bit. So where does this key want to go? In which bucket? The first key. The last one in 1-1. Here is where it goes. This key, where does it want to go? 0-1 here in this bucket. And this key, the green one, wants to go here. So here is the operation that we did. We took this hash table, we copied it. One single block from that copy had to be processed, namely this block. All the other blocks, in this case just one, but in general there can be many, we don't process them. But instead what we do, we just copy pointers to the same block. So now it might get confusing, because in these new blocks we have examined the last two bits of the keys. While in the blocks that we haven't touched, we still look only at the last bit. That's why we need this separate information that tells us how many bits we have examined. Let's see how we use that separate information. So let's suppose we insert 000. Where does it want to go? Since the global I is 2, we examine its last two bits, and this goes to bucket 00, right here. We follow this pointer, and we see that in this bucket we are actually only examining a single bit. And that's okay, there is nothing to do, we just store it here. The next is 1100. Where does this one going to go? Let me do this green.
10.
This one wants to go here. So it ends up in the same place. But now we have an overflow. Do we need to extend the hash table? No, because this number is still smaller than this number. So we just split the current block. And do I have a picture? I have a picture how to split it. But it's quite straightforward. We create a new copy of this block, and we redirect the green arrow to this copy. Which keys go where? Let's say the first key on the top goes where? It stays right here in blue. The next key goes where?
Stays there.
And the next key?
Moves to the green.
Moves to the green one. This moves here. And that's exactly what I show you on the next slide. That's the extensible hash table. In general, we have this structure that tells us the maximum number of bits that we ever expanded. And then there are the buckets. And the buckets, they may disagree on how many bits they have expanded, but never more than 2, more than this number here. Extensible hash tables, I don't think they ever shrink, they only grow. So these numbers can be less than or equal to I. If we have to split a block whose number is less than this global I, then we just split that block. But if we have to split a block whose number is equal to I, then we need to double the size of the extensible hash table. Okay, so that's the extensible hash table. The major criticism, the major disadvantage of this method is that when it grows, it's very disruptive. It doubles in size, which means it can be expensive. We are ending up copying lots of pointers, even if that's in main memory. And what is worse is that the new array may no longer fit in main memory. because it's such a dramatic increase, and we don't like this. So this is why next time we will discuss linear hash tables, that essentially takes the idea of extensible hash tables and just makes it more flexible, so that they can grow one entry at a time. Okay, folks, so I think it's time to stop. Next time we will finish the discussion of linear hash tables, and then move on to query processing. We will discuss the relational algebra, physical operators, and hopefully also some high-level ideas about query optimization. Good. Enjoy the project, and see you next week.